Well, welcome back as we carry on today. I am, again, Dean Reuter, Senior Vice President, General Counsel of the Federalist Society. A special welcome to folks watching on C-SPAN. Welcome back to our conference on the antitrust paradox and the consumer welfare standard. We have spent a lot of time during the day critiquing big is bad and talking about the use of antitrust in tech, looking at the antitrust paradox, the consumer welfare standard, so forth and so on. But a lot of it has amounted to critiques and assessment. And that reminds me of a very quick story that I thought Senator Lee might enjoy as a fellow father and fellow author. This very quick story involves a 7 or 8 year old girl. I don't know how old she was, but her mother was an author. And she confided in her mother one day. She said, "Mom," that's what she calls her mother, "Mom, I know I'm not allowed to get angry and yell at you. So when I get frustrated with you, I go on Amazon and I read all your one-star reviews." That is a brutal form of assessment, I think. But so we're very pleased to have Senator Mike Lee here for our closing address. He was elected in 2010 as Utah's 16th senator. And every time I see that, it's a surprisingly small number to be the 16th senator of a state in this country. He acquired a deep and lasting respect for the Constitution at the knee of Rex Lee, who served as a Solicitor General, his father, a Solicitor General under President Ronald Reagan. Senator Lee graduated BYU with an undergraduate degree in political science and from the law school in 1997. And I think you were the Federal Society chapter president 2 years in a row. That's a record. We usually only have 1 year presidents, but thank you for that. And then he was clerk to Judge D. Benson on the U.S. District Court in the District of Utah, after which he clerked for Judge Sam Alito, then on the Third Circuit, also clerked later for Justice Sam Alito on the U.S. Supreme Court. And in between there, he was at the law firm of Sidley Austin, so he's practiced law. He's been a U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney, and also served as Governor Huntsman's general counsel. So he's had a wide and varied career. Perhaps most important for our purposes here today, he is the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, Competition Policy, and Consumer Rights. And I'll hold this book up. He wrote the introduction to this newly released edition of The Antitrust Paradox. Senator Lee.
Thanks so much, Dean. I'm scared to death that one of my kids is going to hear that story now, and they're going to review my one-star reviews. But then again, I'm a politician. They don't have to dig nearly as deeply as going to one-star reviews on Amazon. They can get that on any social media platform, or for that matter, any newspaper. I am grateful for the invitation, Dean, and for your kind introduction. It really is an honor to join you today. I ran the Federalist Society 2 years in a row there, and we had the largest student section in the entire country at the time because we had a very aggressive membership drive. We'd go and talk to everyone about it, and anyone who expressed any interest at all, we would just sign them up, and then over time we would hope to be able to collect the dues, and then we had a separate fund from which we could draw to pay people's dues in case they were being cheap. So we kept our rolls high, and it ended up having the effect of bringing a lot of activity, and it worked out well. But I'm especially excited to talk to you about this topic, to contribute to today's discussion about the legacy and the importance as an ongoing matter of Judge Bork's masterpiece, The Antitrust Paradox. Specifically, there are two observations that I'd like to make at the very outset. The first is to stress the continued importance of Judge Bork's work. When I returned to the book to write the introduction for its re-release a few months ago, I was struck by how relevant and really how timely it has remained and still is. Sadly, and ironically, we're today witnessing repeated calls from the left to return to the exact same failed enforcement policies and legal standards that Judge Bork helped to expose as economically unsound and is actually harmful to consumers. Listen for a minute to how he described the state of antitrust law in 1978, and tell me how different it is from today. Here's what he wrote. The trends observable in antitrust are four: a movement away from political decision by democratic processes and toward political choice by courts. Two, a movement away from the ideal of free markets and towards the ideal of regulated markets. Three, a tendency to be concerned with group welfare rather than general welfare. And four, a movement away from the ideal of liberty and reward according to merit and toward an ideal of equality of outcome and reward according to status. We see the exact same trends in the law today. The exact same trends are at work in this area of the law. The left has invigorated its calls to abandon the consumer welfare standard and return to an era in which judges condemned mergers, resulting in a mere 5% of market share. And they justified it with a political assessment, essentially that big is bad. The new antitrust laws proposed by House Democrats are not antitrust laws at all, but rather thinly veiled attempts to regulate broad swaths of the American economy, and indeed American society. And we have Democratic members of the Federal Trade Commission suggesting that competition concerns should somehow give way to concerns about climate change and racial equity. Now look, we should all be able to agree that our passion for a particular policy does not make antitrust law the appropriate tool for addressing it. For example, I'm very pro-life, and I'm very anti-war. Notwithstanding my great passion for both of these things, it doesn't mean that antitrust laws are the appropriate mechanism for achieving policy ends that I think are appropriate. Worse than a nightmare, what's happening in this area is like deja vu all over again. Like so many features of the Biden administration, this is a return to the economic doldrums of the 1970s. I mean, look, bell bottoms were fun. They were interesting. There was some of the rock music that came out of that era that was fantastic. There are other aspects of the 1970s that are better left in the ash heap of history. And like the Carter presidency, the Biden FTC is quickly yielding the fruits of combining inexperience and ideology. Unfortunately, we once again have a federal agency, a powerful one at that, run by self-proclaimed experts who are as supremely confident in their ability to regulate business as they are lacking in understanding of the businesses they seek most to control. Instead of being pro-competition, this new movement has declared itself to be anti-monopoly. Now, look, it's good marketing, and it sounds nice on some level, but if you really look at this, it's terrible, terrible policy. Far from representing some renewed effort to protect competition, the quote-unquote anti-monopoly idea is a sleight of hand, one that's meant to move the conversation away from specific conduct, specific anti-competitive conduct, and whether or not that conduct harms competition and how it might harm competition. The anti-monopoly idea would instead say that all that matters, is a firm's size. You look to the size and that tells you everything you need to know, according to this line of reasoning. Now, that position is both unserious and economically illiterate. Even the briefest moment of reflection will demonstrate its patent absurdity. So if you're anti-monopoly, then are you also anti-patent? Patents are, after all, government-granted monopolies. Since the Statute of Anne, this has been the focus of modern Anglo-American intellectual property law. To grant these things for limited times. The whole purpose of the patent is and has long been to allow the holder of the intellectual property right to exclude competition for a limited period of time and to charge the highest price that the market will bear. But we allow this because the prospect of collecting monopoly profits acts as an incentive to innovate and to invest in new ideas that otherwise wouldn't be brought to bear, wouldn't come to market, would never even come to exist, but for that incentive. Now, the same principle is at work in market monopolies that are outside this realm of intellectual property rights. The prospect of obtaining a monopoly through competition on the merits incentivizes competitors to offer consumers better products and services at lower prices. This free market system, built on competition and innovation, is responsible for many of the great achievements of mankind and the economic flourishing of the greatest civilization the world has ever known. But even more important is the foundational principle of our republic, that the law deals with conduct, not with status. We punish people for what they do, not who they are. And when we run afoul of that, whenever we get that backwards and attack people for who they are rather than what they do, bad things always happen. That always ends in tears and often worse. The big is bad abandons that fundamental principle of American law, of American policy orientation. Instead, the facile insistence on being simply anti-monopoly belies the proponent's true priorities. It means being anti-business, even when it hurts consumers. It is the economic version of cutting off your nose to spite your face. And it's about as productive as that. As I've already mentioned, the big is bad philosophy is part of the broader effort to overturn the consumer welfare standard. This critical component of antitrust law has been widely and badly misunderstood, often as a result of willful, deliberate misrepresentation. The consumer welfare standard does not protect monopolists. It does not mean the government always loses, and it is not limited to a narrow focus on prices. Rather, the consumer welfare standard is a statement about the overarching goals of antitrust law, namely that the purpose of antitrust is to advance the economic welfare of consumers, as opposed to protecting the competitors themselves or advancing unrelated social policy, and that unelected judges should not be imposing political preferences. As I noted in my introduction, Judge Bork himself explicitly described the consumer welfare standard as being broader than price and including quality, innovation, and consumer choice. In other words, whatever consumers value, that is what is captured by the concept of consumer welfare. But it's much easier to argue against the consumer welfare standard by pretending that it cares only about lower prices and therefore is incapable somehow of addressing consumer harm in markets with free products, such as many online services. This misrepresentation, and it is a flagrant misrepresentation, says a lot about the true goals of the big is bad crowd and the anti-monopoly crowd, those who think that antitrust laws are just about being against any and every monopoly everywhere, regardless of conduct, are sorely mistaken. If they really cared about the non-price facets of competition, then they wouldn't need to abandon the consumer welfare standard to promote those very facets. But that isn't their true goal. While they hide behind the claim that no one really knows what the consumer welfare standard means, the real problem they have with the consumer welfare standard is the way that it constrains judges from advancing unrelated policy goals. It turns out the push to abandon the consumer welfare standard is not about stopping monopolies or helping consumers. It's simply a Trojan horse for woke social policy. Of course, none of this would surprise Judge Bork, who explained all of this in The Antitrust Paradox, and especially when he explained, quote, "The intellectual's preference for government economic regulation is attributed to a desire to shift power and prestige from the business class to themselves," close quote. The academics that President Biden has put in charge of competition policy under his administration, have made clear that this is their goal. We know that not because we guess it or by context, but because they have told us. All this makes it even more important for us to judge, for us to keep Judge Bork's scholarship in mind as we work to mitigate the harmful effects that are already coming from President Biden's antitrust regime. We have many shared goals with the left, including reining in the power of big tech and protecting consumers from anti-competitive conduct, which increases prices for everything from housing to healthcare and from groceries to gasoline. But the methods employed by the left go far beyond solving these problems and instead seek to displace competition with regulation. So it will be out of the frying pan into the fire if they get their way. My second observation is that Judge Bork's work remains unfinished. His analysis is there, ready and waiting for us to be able to use it and continue to understand it and implement it, but it remains yet unfinished. As I noted in my introduction, antitrust enforcement and American consumers have benefited greatly from the success of many ideas first presented in the antitrust paradox. First, among those being the consumer welfare standard itself. But there was also at least one piece of advice that has not been heeded, and that is Judge Bork's warning against giving too much deference to convoluted economic analysis in the application of antitrust laws. As he put it, quote, the judge, legislator, or lawyer cannot simply take the word of an economist in dealing with antitrust, for the economists will certainly disagree, close quote. And elsewhere he stated, quote, the real objection to performance tests and efficiency defenses in antitrust law is that they're spurious. They cannot measure the factors relevant to consumer welfare, so that after the economic extravaganza was completed, we should know no more than before it began, close quote. And yet, modern antitrust enforcement and judicial decision-making has become obsessed with precisely this sort of economic extravaganza. Judge Bork wrote that economists, like other people, will measure what is susceptible of measurement and will tend to forget what is not, though what is forgotten may be far more important than what is measured. Now, this is exactly what has happened. As courts and enforcers have given in to entertaining complex econometrics that purportedly disprove or justify what is plainly anti-competitive behavior, they allow theory to trump facts. I worry that this is heading in a bad place, and that this fetishizing of economic analysis has become the right's version of the cult of the expert. What's more, it's also likely led to diluted antitrust enforcement efforts that in turn have created many of the competition problems that we face today. It makes good sense that the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are going after Google and Facebook for possible antitrust violations. But imagine if they had simply gotten it right the first time. It is for this reason that we can agree with those on the left that the status quo in antitrust law is no longer tenable. As Judge Bork also wrote, quote, the goal of the antitrust statutes, as they now stand, should be constant. The economic rules that implement that goal should not, close quote. For example, why do we keep referring to online platforms as free services when we obviously pay for them, albeit pay for them with our personal data, our time, and our content, all of which they monetize? The challenges posed by big tech, but also in many other markets and areas of our economy, has given us enough evidence by now to know that we've had an overcorrection since Judge Bork first wrote the antitrust paradox. But again, where we diverge with the left is the appropriate response. The radical changes called for by today's progressives would only make things worse, and really, really worse. Never forget, they don't want to break up big tech to protect you. They want to control it, to use big tech against you. There is a big difference between those two objectives. Displacing antitrust enforcement with so-called antitrust rulemaking, a completely nonsensical oxymoronic term, by the way, to anyone who knows anything about antitrust or about regulation, will not lead to fewer monopolies. One of the many things that bugs me about that term, it's like saying atheistic religious beliefs. They don't really exist in the same universe. It would simply transfer monopoly power from private business to government bureaucrats. And that's hardly an improvement. Nonetheless, our current approach to antitrust enforcement calls out for improvement. Antitrust is not a panacea for every social ill. But I'm heartened that conservatives are once again discovering its importance in ensuring free markets. We must forcefully oppose the do-nothingism advocates, of those who espouse a techno-libertarianism that's utterly incompatible with conservatives' dedication to human flourishing. Conservatives must not and can never put ensouled persons before incorporated persons. The fact is, concentrated economic power can be just as dangerous as concentrated political power, and one tends to lead inevitably to the other. And just as the Constitution's checks and balances and limitations on state power were constructed to ensure political freedom for the people, so too should our antitrust statutes and enforcement be focused on ensuring economic freedom for people, for actual consumers. It should be intuitive for the conservative that freedom from state tyranny has little worth if the state abandons you to the whims of monopolists engaging in anti-competitive behavior. We must reject the cold and shallow conception of liberty that would congratulate a man for throwing off the shackles of big government only to be encumbered with those of big business. Big business, which will in turn lead only to big government in the end. So where do we go from here? Well, I've given my own answer in the form of the Tougher Enforcement Against Monopolies, or TEAM Act. It's the most beautiful piece of antitrust legislation that's been introduced in at least a century. For those of you who haven't read it yet, I'd encourage you to do so. It's getting only 5-star reviews on Amazon and everywhere else where it's been read. The TEAM Act combats both the statist impulses of the progressive left and the laissez-faire economics of radical libertarians. The TEAM Act would eliminate the FTC's role in antitrust enforcement and transfer its resources and its personnel to the Department of Justice, where they could have greater political accountability. This is necessary not just to make it more effective and more efficient, which it certainly would, but also because just as the Catholic Church could not function with two popes serving at the same time, just as there would be huge problems if we tried to have two presidents of the United States serving simultaneously. You can't have two battling antitrust enforcement entities operating within the same space. A little bit like the comedian who years ago said that he likes to put his humidifier and his dehumidifier in the same room and watch as they battle it out. The TEAM Act would also codify the consumer welfare standard. It would codify it to prevent judges from using antitrust for political purposes and to make sure that we stay true to its purpose, which is protecting competition rather than protecting individual competitors. It would strengthen antitrust enforcers by significantly increasing their funding. It would strengthen antitrust remedies by allowing indirect purchasers to recover damages and allowing the Department of Justice to recover treble damages on behalf of consumers. And it would strengthen the antitrust laws by tightening the standard for merger review and making it harder for monopolists to excuse anti-competitive conduct. Now, unfortunately, President Biden's administration has given its answer to these challenges as well, to politicize antitrust enforcement by pursuing novel theories of non-economic harm unrelated to competition, burden struggling American business through regulatory harassment, and generally to transform antitrust from a body of law designed to promote and protect competition into a backdoor for expansive regulation and a command and control economy. I don't think we'll have to wait very long to get the receipts back on this approach. Much like everything else President Biden has pursued recently, I don't think it's going to end well. That being the case, there's much for all of us to do to achieve a sensible but forceful approach to antitrust enforcement that promotes competition, protects consumers, and reduces, instead of expands, the role of government in our economy and in our society generally. Judge Bork's scholarship will necessarily be an indispensable aid in that very project. And with that, I'd like to conclude my remarks by reading the final passage of my introduction to this new edition. All of this serves to highlight the enormous contribution that Judge Bork has made to antitrust law and policy. He advocated for changes that ultimately became law, and his defense of those views continues to be a reliable guide for both present and future. The antitrust paradox remains an indispensable treatise. Judge Bork had that rare genius that allows a man to speak not only to his own time, but to that of his successors as well. His incisive defense of the rule of law and the priority of consumer welfare and the application of the antitrust statutes are timeless contributions to our nation's legal and economic framework. That is, at least as far as antitrust law is concerned, the fact remains that we live in Robert Bork's America, and we are better off for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Lee. We've arranged for a book signing out in the promenade, so we will all go there. We're skipping questions and answers today so we can get to the book signing. We're technically out of time. So, but for that book signing, we are adjourned. Thanks so very much, everyone, and thank you, Senator Lee.